the Carter Subaru Studios. This is the G and Ursula Show with G Scott and Ursula Royteam.
For almost 9 months, we have been dealing with this global pandemic, unfortunately. And consistently every single week, we bring on our very own virologist who has been so gracious to come on our show every single week. And if you have questions for Dr. Rasmussen, please send those in. 98973 is the State Roofing text line. I'd like to ask those questions for you. But Ursula, we have a guest.
Yes, we do. And as we've been reporting, we now have three vaccine candidates. And the Operation Warp Speed science advisor says we could get back to normal by May. We want to talk about that with Dr. Angela Rasmussen. And here she is. Good morning, Angie.
Good morning, Ursula.
So let's start off with what Dr. Monef Salawi has been saying. And this is about when can we finally go back to normal and do the things that we want to do? And this is what he said in terms of the vaccine.
So normally, with the level of efficacy we have, 95%, 70% or so of the population being immunized would allow for true herd immunity to take place. That is likely to happen somewhere in the month of May or something like that, based on our plans. I really hope and look forward to seeing that the level of negative perception of the vaccine decreases and people's acceptance increase. That's going to be critical to help us. Most people need to be immunized before we can go back to a normal life.
Your thoughts on that?
Well, I think Dr. Slawi is correct in saying that we definitely need more people to accept taking a vaccine. And that really is on him. That's also on scientists like myself who are involved in communicating with the public to really be clear with the public about what the data says, about what the limitations and advantages to all these different vaccines are. But I think that besides that, we also need to be very careful about saying that we will have reached the herd immunity threshold by May of next year. There are a number of things, both scientific and logistical, that go into this. First of all, we don't know that these vaccines will be 95% efficacious once they're rolled out to a much larger mm-hmm. population. That estimate is based on approximately 170 events in the phase 3 clinical trial. It's always a challenge to try to extrapolate data from a small group of people to a much larger, very diverse population. In addition to that, there are some significant logistical challenges to distributing these vaccines. And for all of us to have access to these vaccines by May of next year is really going to be, I think, something that will depend on how well these vaccines are actually rolled out and distributed. So people do need to be hopeful and cautiously optimistic. But at the same time, we should not take it as a given that we will definitely all be back to our normal lives by next May.
Dr. Rasmussen, the other thing that is really bubbling up right now is that more and more public health experts are saying that it looks like it is safe to go back to in-person learning, in particular with some of the younger grades. And they're saying that the latest data does not show any compelling evidence that in-person schooling leads to big COVID outbreaks. Can you talk about that? Because it sounds like we have to really change the messaging if that, in fact, is the case.
Well, I think that this recent data, and I'm not entirely sure what this is referring to, but one thing people do need to keep in mind about this is that right now it's very difficult to look at COVID transmission in schools just because there is COVID spreading throughout the mm-hmm. overall communities to such an extent that it's really hard to look specifically at schools. And the second thing about that is that the data being collected from schools has not really been consistent. So we don't have really good, unbiased data from these schools to analyze. So these analyses are somewhat limited. Now, I think that we definitely need to be balancing the value of having in-person education, which is a tremendous benefit to kids as well as their parents, mm-hmm. With the dangers of COVID spreading through the community. And really what this comes down to is if we can get community transmission back down to manageable levels in which we can, you know, conduct surveillance, do contact tracing, make sure we're isolating cases and controlling this really this unmitigated spread, then I think we should definitely have a serious conversation about doing whatever we need to do to make sure that in-person schooling can be safe. But I don't think that the science is conclusive that it's perfectly 100% safe to reopen schools just because of the risk to transmission outside of those schools, that the transmission that can happen if it does spread in schools, people bringing that back to their own households and it's spreading from there throughout the community.
Okay, Dr. Rasmussen, I got listener questions as they come in right now. 253 wants to know, can you ask the good doctor why the antibodies from catching COVID do not last, but antibodies from a vaccine would?
Okay, that's a great question, and I'll try to answer that without getting too far into the weeds scientifically. First of all, we don't really know if those antibodies are lasting, and that sort of depends on which time scale you're talking about. So far, a number of studies have shown that about 90% of people at least who are infected with SARS coronavirus 2 do develop antibody responses, and that those will persist for months after infection. Now, at the same time, we've only really known about this virus for, just barely under a year. So we really can't say beyond that time period how long these antibodies will last or what kind of protective immunity they will offer in years to come. So that's one thing. I don't think it's at all settled that infection doesn't produce protective antibody responses that are durable. The reason why vaccines may actually be better, though, is that, first of all, if you get a vaccine, you're not going to get SARS coronavirus 2, and that is a huge benefit in itself. We won't have a lot of people getting infected if people are being immunized by vaccines rather than through natural infection. Another thing is that virus, and this is a little bit more of a scientific issue, viruses have the capability to manipulate their host's immune system. So it may be that, and there is some data that supports this, that people who are infected with SARS coronavirus 2 will develop immune responses, but they may not develop as robust of immunological memory. That's the ability of the immune system essentially to stick around and keep producing antibodies for years to come. Because the virus is capable of subverting the host's immune system, it may be that some of these memory responses are not as robust or as efficient. But again, that is something that's very much an active area of study. And the final thing is that in the preliminary clinical trials and preclinical studies using monkeys, it is shown that vaccines induce antibody titers that are on the higher end of the spectrum from patients who have recovered from COVID. So people, after they recover from COVID, will have a pretty big range from person to person of the amount of antibodies that are measurable in their blood. And vaccines appear to be inducing levels of antibodies that are closer to the higher end of that scale. So all of those things together really, I think, argue for using vaccination as the tool to reach herd immunity compared to through natural infection.
206 asks, question, if my kids are getting tested in college and traveling and then getting tested again when they get here and then a 14-day quarantine, is that going to be good enough? I don't think that they should at all travel, but I want to know your opinion.
Well, I think that's certainly good enough to reintegrate them back into their household. With or without testing, a 14-day quarantine is what's recommended for making sure that somebody does not have COVID. I think that with the question of travel is a different question. That is suggesting that are you willing to accept the risk that in traveling, your kid or you might become infected? And that's something that people are going to have to decide for themselves. But it is a very tricky question because kids traveling home from college is a little bit different than people traveling on a trip to go visit relatives that might not necessarily be absolutely critical. In many places, kids are not able to stay, young adults are not able to stay at their colleges, so they really have no choice but to travel. Mm-hmm. So if they do travel, regardless of their ability to access testing, they should quarantine, including from members of their household that they're staying in, for 14 days to make sure they're safe.
That's such great advice, because this is happening right now, and in fact it's happening in my household. But I took your advice the last time we chatted, Dr. Rasmussen. Okay, so the people of Britain, this is just happening now, they've just been told that they will be allowed to mix households from the 23rd to the 27th of December. Do you think that that is a crazy thing to do, or is something different happening in Britain that would allow this change?
I do think that's a crazy thing to do if that's not accompanied with a quarantine for the households that are planning on mixing for 14 days prior to that. To me, that sounds like just suspending good public health practices so that people can celebrate Christmas together. And again, they can, assuming that they are quarantining before they actually mix those households. And in many cases, people will actually not be able to do that. So I think people need to be very, very cautious taking advice like that, because certainly the situation in Britain has improved. They had a short lockdown that has really reduced their numbers of cases that they're having every day, but they still do have widespread transmission in the United Kingdom. I think that the people need to be very, very careful anywhere, especially in the UK and in the US, prior to mixing households for holiday gatherings.
I want to go back to the discussion about vaccines. And as of right now, we've got three potential ones that look very promising. And today, Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar said the vaccines will be distributed largely. That discussion, it'll be left up to state governors. Do you think that should be done on a federal level, or is it better to be done on a statewide level?
Well, so that statement is a bit confusing to me, because earlier you had a clip from Dr. Slowey, the head of Operation Warp Speed, talking about the federal plans to distribute these vaccines. Mm-hmm. So I think that Secretary Azar is referring to the fact that the on-the-ground logistics work will be largely carried out by state officials, you know, in state health departments that are presided over by those state governors. I think that though federally, they will definitely be involved in terms of Operation Warp Speed in distributing these vaccines nationally. And I know that that has been a big focus of Operation Warp Speed, are the vaccine distribution effort.
Okay. Got some more questions for you, Dr. Rasmussen, from the 253. If the vaccine doesn't stop you from getting the virus, and it just lessens the symptoms, are you still able to transmit the virus? In other words, does the vaccine stop community spread, or do as many people get COVID that just don't get sick?
So that's an excellent question, because it's a big question that's on my mind as well. And right now we actually don't have much data about that. So some of the clinical trials that we've been hearing about, specifically Pfizer and Moderna, to my knowledge, they haven't been systematically collecting data on viral loads from the people who have been participating in the trial. So we don't really have much information about whether or not these people are just experiencing amelioration of disease severity versus they're actually being protected against productive infection and therefore not able to transmit. So this is going to be an incredibly important question. One of the reasons for that is that it's going to take months to actually roll these vaccines out to the larger public. There may be problems with vaccine hesitancy, as we were discussing a bit earlier. Mm-hmm. So if people are getting vaccinated, they are not having severe disease, potentially asymptomatic disease, but they're still infected, they could actually relax their behaviors and transmit the virus to people who have not had the vaccine and may still be at risk for developing more severe disease. So this is a really, really important question, and I think it's one of the first things that the vaccine manufacturers and the government and public health officials really need to look into as soon as possible.
Dr. Rasmussen, we appreciate you coming on with us every single week. Again, it's been almost 9 months, and so we just want to say thank you for coming on and answering our questions that we have.
And enjoy the holidays, too.
Yes.
Yeah, you too. Happy Thanksgiving. And please, please be safe and virtual if possible.
Real quick, before you go, is turkey overrated or underrated for Thanksgiving?
You know, I know a lot of people don't like turkey, but I think it's underrated. I really like turkey if it's cooked properly. So this year, my technique is anyways to use a dry brine that keeps the bird juicy. A lot of times I think people don't like turkey because it's very dry. But I find that if you dry brine it, it saves a lot of those natural juices, and it's actually delicious and a nice change to chicken.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving to you, too.
Tell Taz hello.
He says hi and happy Thanksgiving.
All right.
Hey, I've got some good news.